Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Oil at $100 a barrel? As of today, we've been there and we've done that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Siemens. From strengthened urban infrastructures to sustainable environmental solutions to advanced healthcare technology, Siemens' 70,000 U.S. employees are providing solutions for America.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Wednesday. It is the 2nd of January today. And before we get too far ahead of ourselves to start the new year, there are some caveats that come with that $100 mark for crude. First, it was just a single trade on the floor of the New York Mercantile Exchange that hit triple digits. Oil closed at $99.62 a barrel in New York. That was a record, by the way. The other thing to remember is that little thing called inflation. Back in 1980, crude hit what would be $101.70 in today's money. But still, $100 is $100, and it's a number to reckon with, economically speaking. So we asked Marketplace's Steve Tripoli to get us a sense of whether prices this high might be here for a while, and if they are, what that might mean.
Addison Armstrong of Tradition Energy thinks oil prices may briefly burst higher from here. But like plenty of other analysts, he predicts that this year's average oil price will wind up much lower, closer to $75 a barrel.
I think that will be driven by a reduction in demand, not only from the U.S., but as the U.S. slows, I would expect that we'll see economic slowdowns in China and India.
Armstrong says Americans are already cutting back, and not just on oil. He thinks final holiday sales figures will prove disappointing, and he adds that Americans are already eating out less as well as buying less gasoline.
All of those things are telling myself and my colleagues that oil prices have now been too high for too long, and the U.S. consumer can no longer support prices at these levels.
Analysts say high oil prices often seed their own decline. People don't want to pay, or can't, and producers respond by adding supply. But if that consensus is wrong and oil stays high, the risks of a recession rise. And in this already fragile economy, the worry is it could be a nasty one. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Dana Perino, the president's press secretary, said today the White House is not inclined to tap into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to push prices lower. And the Department of Energy announced it's going to keep on buying crude to bring the SPR up to its full capacity. You might want to get out your inflation calculators one more time for a peek at gold prices. It topped $859 an ounce today, which beats the 1980 record for the shiny yellow stuff. Adjusted to today's dollars, that would be almost $2,200 an ounce. Oil was one thing driving Wall Street lower today. The nation's factories were the other. Manufacturing ended a 10-month growth spurt in December. A closely watched index that a guy named Ben Bernanke is known to pay close attention to sank to its lowest point in almost 5 years, as our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay reports.
American manufacturers struggled when the dollar was strong. Their products were too expensive overseas. Now the dollar is weaker, but today's report from the Institute for Supply Management says manufacturers are still in trouble. Joel Naroff is the chief economist for Commerce Bank. He blames the housing bust.
All the industries that had supplied this booming housing market is no longer able to do that, and they're seeing a real reduction in orders.
That probably means layoffs at factories, says Nigel Galt. He's an economist at Global Insight. He says today's numbers don't mean the economy's in the tank.
It shows that the risks of recession are high. It certainly doesn't seal the case because we've had manufacturing readings like this in the past without the full economy going to recession.
Both Galt and Naroff say the economy depends on Americans staying employed and spending. They say the service sector will have to stay strong to keep the U.S. out of recession. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay from Marketplace.
The federal government wants to think for just a little bit longer about a proposed buyout of 3Com, the computer network company. Bain Capital is orchestrating the deal, but with a Chinese partner, which is what has the feds a bit spooked. The Chinese company would get a 15% stake of 3Com, so this week the Treasury Department is expected to extend its review for another month and a half. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
Here's the hang-up. 3Com supplies technology to the Defense Department. It prevents intruders from hacking into the Pentagon's computers. The Pentagon suspects China of orchestrating a massive cyber attack last year. Critics say if the Chinese company called Huawei Technologies buys a chunk of 3Com, it would be like the fox guarding the high-tech henhouse.
This is a very clear-cut national security concern issue.
Moyara Rusin of the Monterey Institute of International Studies says Bain Capital may not be able to head off the security issue. Even if the deal holds up, Bain could be forced to sell the 3Com division supplying technology to the Pentagon.
I don't know how easy that would be to do because, well, maybe that's what makes it an attractive investment.
China has already invested about $1 trillion in the U.S. over the past 7 years, but a lot of that went into treasury bonds. It's more unusual for the Chinese to invest directly in a U.S. company. And economists say the Chinese government could have direct influence over 3Com because it usually helps appoint the directors of Chinese companies. UCLA political science professor Richard Baum says U.S. politicians will criticize the deal to attract voters suspicious of China.
For those constituencies, the message that plays positively is a message of warnings of a Chinese economic threat.
Perhaps anticipating that, Bain Capital issued a statement today stressing that 3Com would remain firmly under American control. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Wall Street must have had a whopper of a New Year's hangover today because the Dow turned in its worst ever opening day performance. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you're sick and tired of hearing about the Iowa caucuses, just imagine what it's like for people who actually live in the Hawkeye State. It's all over tomorrow night, or perhaps it's all just beginning. Healthcare is among the top issues Democrats in Iowa say they are worried about. It is second only to the war in Iraq for them. But commentator Susan Lee says most of the candidates' healthcare proposals ignore one vital issue.
Medicine has been fabulously successful in treating acute and infectious disease, and so more Americans are living longer. But unfortunately, living longer increases the chances of developing chronic conditions, stuff like heart disease, diabetes, hypertension, and asthma. Right now, about half of all Americans have at least one chronic disease, accounting for almost 80% of all health care expenditures. This is alarming, yes, but now for something really scary. About one quarter of all Americans have more than one chronic disease, and 10% of those have an average of 5 chronic conditions, which, by the way, accounts for fully two-thirds of Medicare spending. Here's a quick look at why chronic disease drives up costs. Say a person suffers from high blood pressure. Her doctor prescribes a beta blocker. Fine, except that the beta blocker then aggravates her asthma. Best case, she has to pay an expensive visit to her asthma doctor. Worst case, she ends up in the really expensive ER. So the problem is that treatment for chronic diseases uses what's called a silo model. Each disease is treated like a freestanding problem with its own specialist. And proliferating doctors and medications have predictable results, like duplicate testing and dangerous drug interactions, which drive unnecessary visits to doctors' offices or ERs. A truly determined effort to get spending under control would attack the problem of multiple chronic diseases. But instead, we have a dozen people running for president who are pretty much ignoring the issue. Only two of the candidates, John McCain and Hillary Clinton, are advancing concrete ideas to actually reform treatment. So I'd like to add a new disease to the roster, frustration disorder, a condition experienced by anyone hoping to hear good ideas for reducing the cost of health care. During this election cycle, I predict frustration disorder will be a chronic condition among voters.
Economist Susan Lee lives in New York City. You can visit our website to share your thoughts with us. It's marketplace.org. chronically rising cost of health care takes many forms: higher co-pays for consumers, higher payroll expenses for their employers. Scientists looking for cures wind up spending more time trying to fund their research. Dr. Craig Venter is well acquainted with that battle for cash. He's the founder of Celera Genomics, which shared the distinction of being the first to decode the human genome. And he found his money outside the usual scientific channels. Dr. Venter, good to have you here.
Nice to be with you.
You had to strike your own way to get yourself funded in studying the human genome. How did it come to pass that you went the private sector route instead of what so many other people do and go for government funding?
Well, in fact, we couldn't get government funding because I had a radical new approach. And with the multi-billion dollar federal program, they didn't want to switch and try new ideas. In fact, it was only because an instrument company that was making the sequencing instruments had a new instrument they thought would work with the technique I developed that I got a phone call saying, we have $300 million. Do you want to sequence the human genome? And, you know, how do you answer a question like that? You know,
was there a second hesitation on your part?
Yeah, actually, I blew them off the first three times because I thought they were kidding. I'm glad they called back.
When you talked with your peers about whether or not to accept this private funding and go that route, what did they say? I mean, were there misgivings at that point?
The only concern was, and we made it as a precondition, that if we sequenced the human genome in a private company, that we would be able to publish it and make our findings available to the world, which was a stipulated term, and without that, we wouldn't have done it. Now, I'm part of the XFIS Foundation, where we have a $10 million prize for whoever gets the technology for sequencing genomes to do 100 in a short period of time. So it's gone from exceeded the capabilities of the U.S. government to we're going to have small shops that do hundreds or thousands a day.
So at some point in the not-too-distant future, how do you envision this working out in terms of healthcare and medicine, which is, I would assume, aside from the sheer curiosity of being able to do it, where we're going with this?
The goal is to try and get to a preventative medicine paradigm. It's a lot cheaper to prevent diseases from happening or detect them early than it is to treat them after they occur. Trouble is our society doesn't work in a prevention mode. We like to have big fixes for big problems after they occur. The genetic code can help us understand what diseases we're at risk for and get people to look earlier, change lifestyles. In my case, I'm taking a statin based on what I found in my genome in terms of risk for heart disease. We have to shift third-party payers, the government payers, to prevent disease. And that's the only hope I think we have for changing the double-digit inflation for healthcare costs.
Forgive what might sound like a very, very basic question, but why is this so hard?
Well, when we have a system that does not encourage innovation, that it takes people from different backgrounds, different approaches to have the ability to do innovation. For every Craig Venter that's been successful, there could be 10,000 guys out there or gals that they had their ideas shut down. What I worry about more than anything, I think, is if we're going to move society forward, we need thousands of solutions. We don't need one or two rare events to change what's going on.
Craig Venter's book is called A Life Decoded. Mr. Venter, thanks a lot for coming in.
Great.
Coming up, how do you put a value on undeveloped land?
You go to a state park, a national park, you have a great time. You may not pay anything for that. There's no market transaction involved, but you benefit fairly directly from that recreational amenity.
But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, the wah-wah trombones. The Dow Industrials plummeted 1 2/3% today, 220 points to close at 13,043. I love those trombones. The NASDAQ plunged 1 6/10%, 42 points to close at 2609. The S&P 500 sank 1 4/10%, 21 points to end the day at 1447. A downgrade by Bank of America chipped away at Intel, the world's largest semiconductor company, saw its shares tumble almost 5%. Those gloomy manufacturing numbers that Jill Barshay was telling us about crushed U.S. steel. Today, shares of the world's seventh largest steel producer dropped 6% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.91%. and you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org. Every day's Marketplace is put together the day of. If you want to get the show info as it's being created, sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It also includes upcoming special projects on the show. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. In Detroit, automakers release their sales figures for December. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for November. And January 3rd marks the four-year anniversary of Mars rover Spirit. The golf cart-sized robotic explorer is 977 Martian days past warranty, but keeps on ticking. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has been trying to talk reconciliation with Kenyan political leaders today. More than 300 people have been killed in the wake of a disputed presidential election there this past weekend. The political violence is threatening to disrupt what had been a solid Kenyan economy. It's the biggest and most stable in East Africa, and Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports problems there could have far-reaching effects.
Kenya is strategically crucial to the entire East Africa region. Its seaports and airports connect Uganda, Rwanda, and Burundi to the rest of the world. Plus, many aid organizations focused on economic development are headquartered in Nairobi. While the current unrest centers around the disputed election, many observers say the real issue is the rampant corruption that has primarily benefited a select few in the president's inner circle. Gerald Lamel is executive director of the advocacy group Africa Action. He says Kenya's 6% economic growth is threatened.
We have seen strong economies fight through this kind of corruption in the past, but I think we've reached a boiling point in Kenya that we've not seen in its history. I think that a resolution is extremely important to the economic progress in Africa.
Investor confidence is also in danger. The weekly tea auction, the world's biggest, has been postponed. Mark Bellamy is a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and a former U.S. ambassador to Kenya. He says the unrest threatens the tourist industry, which brings in $900 million a year.
A good part of the economic growth in recent years has been a result of increased tourism. And the tourism business is a fickle one, a volatile one, and I would expect that there might be some hesitation in that sector.
International human rights groups accuse Kenya's police of violently repressing protests. Nonetheless, despite a government ban, the rival political party plans to stage a mass rally tomorrow. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Kenya is the second foreign policy crisis for the United States in the past 2 weeks. It's also the second that could have wider economic repercussions. The assassination of Benazir Bhutto a week ago tomorrow threatens to stall the Pakistani economy. It's been growing better than 7% a year, largely on the rising economic power of Pakistani consumers. Dilawar Syed is a Pakistani-American from Silicon Valley. He's with the Organization of Pakistani Entrepreneurs there, and he is also just back from a trip to Pakistan. Mr. Syed, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
What do you suppose the effect of Ms. Bhutto's assassination is going to have on business and entrepreneurship in Pakistan?
First of all, clearly a huge tragic event. This was the John F. Kennedy moment for Pakistanis worldwide. Impact on all aspects of society is fairly deep. When it comes to business, I think one has to step back and look at the fact that Pakistan economy is a fairly resilient economy. It's a nation of 165 million people. We've seen over the past few years, the economy has done fairly well, averaging about 7% growth. So the impact near term, clearly, there will be a negative impact. But by and large, you know, as I was leaving the country, I felt like the nation was limping back to normalcy.
What would be your guess as to how long it might take for the economy to get itself going again, to stabilize and really start moving forward the way it has been for the past couple of years?
maybe, you know, probably a few months when we'll see stability returning to the country politically. And as elections are held, which we know will be held, you will see investor confidence getting restored. Though, you know, a major part of the Pakistan economy is very much consumer-driven. And one thing that struck me this time when I was in Pakistan is how much of a consumer-driven economy we have. So much like we saw, you know, after 9/11, consumers, you know, spending and continuing to spend, I think the Pakistan economy will do just fine as long as the consumer confidence is not hurt. So that would be a big factor.
The election has been postponed, as we learned the other day. What, in your opinion, is the best outcome now for businesses in Pakistan and the United States out of that election?
I think the best outcome would be that you have a strong government, you have a government that people have confidence in, and a government who continues to, you know, push the agenda for the advancement of the country. You know, there were some good economic gains made in the country in the past few years. We do have some challenges with respect to, you know, our current account deficit. We have challenges with respect to our inflation. We import a good portion of our energy needs in Pakistan. So there will be pressures for the new government to adjust the oil price for the local consumer. But having said that, I think as long as you have good economic managers running the economy as part of a hopefully a stable government, I think Pakistan will get back on the path to growth again.
Would you put your capital on the line right now in Pakistan?
I will. Again, if I am a long-term investor, and I will take a few months, obviously, you know, to monitor the situation very carefully. The outcome of the election is a very important factor.
But you'd be a little nervous, is what I hear you saying.
Of course, of course. I mean, I think that it'll be foolhardy not to be nervous. But I would hope that you would look past the immediate future, which does look shaky. As long as we, you know, the country there contains violence and there is a stable government in place, it should be comforting to investors.
Dilawar Sayed is the president of the Silicon Valley chapter of the Organization of Pakistani Entrepreneurs. He's just back this past weekend from a trip in December to Pakistan. Mr. Sayed, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
The art of setting consumer prices is, in most cases, more of a science, really. For manufactured goods, it's a fairly straightforward process, the costs of production plus a profit margin. For commodities that we get from nature, say oil or gas, prices are a bit more speculative. Today is a great example of that. But what about the price of nature itself? As forests and wetlands continue to shrink, some local governments are turning to the market for a solution. From the Marketplace Innovations Desk at North Carolina Public Radio, Janet Babin reports.
When someone builds an apartment complex or office building, we, the public, can usually find out a lot about it. How much it'll cost, how much the contractor will make, how many tax dollars the project will eat. There are drawings, models, price estimates. But here's what we don't usually find out: how much the land would have been worth if it had been left alone. And that's what New Jersey wanted to know. For years, the state said yes to developers' plans, but now it's running out of space.
We lose about 50 acres a day of natural lands to development of one sort or another.
That's Bill Mates with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. Instead of just blindly saying yes to new development, the state commissioned a report to find out how much New Jersey's land is worth just sitting there, undeveloped. To come up with the numbers, the report considered natural capital, like forests, wetlands, beaches, and open space, and the services they provide, like storm protection, soil erosion prevention, and wastewater treatment. It also considered minerals and agricultural products. Turns out, New Jersey's natural assets are worth a lot.
At least $26 billion a year worth of goods and services. And that $26 billion a year is worth about $850 billion in present value terms.
Values the amount of money you'd have to park in the bank right now at 3% to get $26 billion a year in income. In this case, income is equivalent to the goods and services that New Jersey's land is providing its citizens. The state conducted the study with help from Robert Costanza and researchers at the Gund Institute at the University of Vermont. Costanza says natural resources are usually left out of market equations, so traditionally they're not valued. But he argues they should be.
You go to a state park, a national park, You have a great time. You may not pay anything for that. There's no market transaction involved. But you benefit fairly directly from that recreational amenity.
Let's do it again.
No argument here from 3-year-old Lucas and his extended family. They were playing in the water at this North Carolina State Park. Lucas's grandmother, Jane Eisenberg, grew up in Hoboken. She likes New Jersey's new land valuation plan. She says now Lucas's generation can know exactly how much natural resources, like this park, are worth, and that could help preserve them.
My generation, back in the dark ages, we really didn't think much as children about the fact that these rivers and mountains could go away.
Well, I mean, you know, you guys had a lot going on.
Yeah, this is true. No, we thought when they were going to go away, it would be with the big one, you know.
Now, the big one is not so much a nuclear threat, but sprawl that pressures resources. Some economists, though, don't think pricing a state ecosystem will ease that pressure. In fact, David Weiss with Standard & Poor's says the valuation could make natural capital more vulnerable because a price tag implies that it's for sale.
Well, that's one of the worries. If you say the value of this endangered species is $2 million and somebody wants to build a nuclear plant there and says, here's $2 million, we're building the plant.
Weiss calls the land valuation a subjective academic exercise, but it's not to New Jersey's Bill Mates.
To us, it's anything but an academic exercise. The findings of this report are already being cited by both environmentalists and developers in discussions about land use decisions.
Decisions that could save money, like whether to invest in a wastewater treatment plant or maintain wetlands instead, a move that might accomplish the same public service, clean water, with fewer tax dollars. New Jersey's had inquiries about the report from communities in Michigan and Pennsylvania and from the Federal Environmental Protection Agency. But so far, the state has yet to use its report to challenge a developer's plans. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of a well-diversified college savings plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, it's a new year, so the new Australian government is trying to buckle down and trim costs. First thing to go, back rubs. Turns out government workers spent about $96,000 taxpayer dollars, that's American money, by the way, on massages in 2004. Those are the most recent figures available to Australian papers today. Apparently, the practice was widespread under former Prime Minister John Howard. His staff alone spent about $5,000 on rubdowns this year. If you thought it was bad in Washington, well, there you go. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow shed 220 points, 1 2/3%. The Nasdaq sloughed off 42 points, 1 6/10%. The S&P 500 skipped down 21 points. That is 1 4/10%. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbornoni, Eric Johnson, Aaron Scott, and Phil Stearns engineer the program for us. Coming up next time, more news from Down Under. An Aussie law firm changes the path one takes to make partner.
The traditional models for ownership really lack the flexibility necessary to reward talented young lawyers.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.